This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Now, thank you very much for the invitation. It is, of course, coming from Europe, it is, of course, a great honor to speak in front of Judge Posner. Such a distinguished faculty, having won a lot of Nobel Prizes, and having said many things we discuss. I must say that because, of course, I come dressed in a very informal way, like a student, as I've been 20 years ago. And perhaps it's telling that British Airways didn't bring my suitcase. and I should rather speak as a student here. Now, this student, Stefan Gründmann, was very impressed by Chicago. I studied in Berkeley at that time, mainly because of this strange mixture between extremely modern and very traditional, in a sense. And I think my little presentation will take up these two strands, extremely modern and traditional. The thing was that at that time, I hadn't seen so much modern architecture and modern art of really our days. But what struck me was that I didn't find one book which explained modern architecture. Seeing that Michelangelo had invented very similar things already 500 years ago. I have three introductory remarks and one thesis only. And perhaps the first introductory remark explains why I have this equilibrium, first so many introductory remarks and then only one thesis. This has to do probably with a book published in the year when I was born, and that is that the different preconception of how you think influence, of course, what you are detecting, a famous book by Esser, a Frankfurt professor. And I would say in Europe, what we tend to think is that whatever we discuss, we think it as a potential rule, which could be applied, which could be legislative, or which judges can apply. And then, of course, there is some simplicity, perhaps, inherent, because, of course, Judge Posner can apply any sophisticated rule, but normally in case law you have to think perhaps about rules which could work in practice as well, and don't make all the differentiations which are possible. Simplicity in this sense has perhaps to do as well with the fact that, of course, I can't tell you, I can now explain all the European cases. You speak about the American cases. In this respect, we speak two different languages as well. And if, of course, I would try to have those differentiations, I would need the European cases, and that would take more than 15 minutes. The second thing is I have a rather large section in my paper on comparative law, which is much too short, of course, but nevertheless. And I would I just want to point out that within civil law, you have all the different shades. You have virtually from strict liability, because you have reversal of burden of proof for fault, and fault is a market standard. And therefore it's virtually strict liability, and you have that in Italian and German law. And you have the other way around, where you have fault principle, and it has to be proven by the promisee, for instance, in French law. So it's by no means homogeneous. But even in those countries where you have strict liability or the fault principle transformed into quasi-strict liability, you have some important exceptions. And one important exception in German law is that you say, well, but the seller is not responsible for the fault of the producer. And even though the producer's fault is virtually a strict liability case, because again, you have a reversal of burden of proof and you have a market standard, you don't have a direct contractual link with the producer. So you can't sue the producer, but you can't sue the seller either, because he doesn't respond for seller's fault. So it's true that in civil law countries, you have all shades of different rules, and you have some civil law countries like Germany where you have a quasi-strict liability regime, but nevertheless you have interesting exceptions which in a longer discourse could of course be compared with common law. In Europe we have this discussion very much because, as you know, the United Kingdom is part of the European Union, and law development takes place nowadays mainly on the European levels. Therefore, we have this discussion quite a bit. My third introductory remark is that the thesis I, the one idea I want to share with you, I think is perhaps rather a modest one, but at the same time, I think it explains quite a bit of what we have discussed today. I think that the contract tort divide can be explained somehow, that there is some good reason to that. Although in economic theory, there may be an overarching theory, but even there, I would say there is some very good reason for this divide, and of course, a specific performance on the one hand, and damages, whether they should be based on fault or strict liability, this controversy between Ariel and Saul, I think it can explain a bit about that as well. What then is this one sentence? The one sentence is if we justify the fault principle in Europe, basically it's still Kantian thinking, and it is basically the idea is that if you have a fault liability system, then you give freedom to freedom of reaction, because the person at the promisor then, so to speak, has the freedom either to choose breach and then respond for it, or when he doesn't have the possibility to choose, then he doesn't have to respond for the breach. That counts only for damages, not for other things, which are costly as well. Restitution can be quite costly as well, but that is the theory. And therefore, many writers, and I would say still the large majority in Europe, would say it's ethically superior to a strict liability system. Now, one of the most famous European legal scholars has thought differently. It's Ernst Rabl, who came to Michigan, and he has introduced the strict liability idea also into the most prominent international convention, which is the Vienna Convention with its Article 79. And I would say that the question ethics versus, he said, well, efficiency or whatever, is not the right question to ask. In my view, this idea based on Kantian thinking just forgets that there are other types of freedom. Richard Epstein has already alluded to freedom of contract, perhaps. I would put it a bit further. In my view, the real problem now in contracts only is that, of course, the promisor loses some of his freedom if he is liable as well for breach, although he's not at fault. You can stress this point, but at the same time, this restriction of freedom in many cases has been chosen before. You have to, at the decisive point in time, we spoke about decisive points in time already quite a bit, is not so much the breach, but there is already the promise. And there are, at the moment of promise, of course, the freedom is to choose between different products. And now the core idea of why I think, as not very many Europeans would do, but some Europeans perhaps as well, why I think that strict liability should be the starting point in contract law, is that clients choose between different products. And in order to be able to choose between the different products, they must be able to compare the different products. And the system which makes products and the outcome of products and the benefit you can receive from product services or goods or whatever more comparable is the better system, because it comes closer to what the parties wanted to choose. Now, comparability is of course fostered by strict liability, because then what you have to assess is only whether the service or the good is in conformity with what you have bargained for. And if then afterwards it is not in conformity with that, then in any case you have damages in Europe, it would be expectation damages, and in Germany it would be even without a limit of foreseeability. Now, comparability, in my view, is the most important point here, and it's freedom of contract at the moment of the promise and not of the breach, because you can bind yourself to saying, well, I choose a regime which afterwards, of course, takes away some of my freedom. Now, having said that, of course, it's perhaps helpful to think of what regime Rabl wrote that for. He wrote that for in his book on sales, and he it was introduced in the Vienna Convention. And therefore, the question is whether it's really the same for all contracts. And in quite a few common law countries, by no means all, but you have this exception of service contracts. That is an interesting exception where you say, well, there is some fault principle in service contracts. I think it's a category which is too rough, too big. There are quite a few service contracts where you would, where I would say, well, you can easily have strict liability, others not. As a matter of fact, you find that, for instance, in payment services, you find that, in, for instance, in work contracts, also in international conventions, that you have strict liability. And I think that the more appropriate, the more refined distinction is one you find in French law, and they invented that already in the beginning of the 20th century, where they distinguish between obligation de moyens et obligation de résultats. So promises of result or promises of best efforts. And I think that is really the core difference, because once you can say the result, the outcome, doesn't show necessarily whether the product brought in, the service, was a good one or not, then you can judge from the result. For instance, medical treatment, if the person I don't want to be too drastic, just suffers a bit more, you don't really know whether it's the medical treatment or not. In other cases, even in services, you can very well judge from the result the quality of the service. And therefore, I say, if it's somehow in the hands, the result, in the hands of the debtor, or of all those who help him, the chain, the production chain, for instance, which I say they the liability has to be for the whole production chain. If it's in the hands, I would say strict liability is the better regime. If it's not in the hands of the promisor, then a fault system is necessary, because you don't have this possibility to judge from the results assess the quality of the service like this, and therefore you have to go the more direct way, which is more difficult to prove and which has all those problems assessing. Now, in my paper, I try to discuss that as well on the side of the client, who normally the client, there is not this question of comparability. The client should be solvent, and that's it, basically. And there are cases, if the client, for instance, doesn't pay because he fell ill for a moment or so, there you can distinguish, but I don't want to go into details here. I just want to distinguish yet another type of contract. You have, among service contracts, you have quite a lot of rather long-term contracts, which somehow even cover good parts of what you are doing. For a labor contract is a typical, the contract of a director with a firm, for instance. And there I would say in labor law it's rather clear, but perhaps it's even an idea for general contract law, for those long-term contracts which encompass a full-time job, so to speak, to say, well, basically, and that comes close to this pattern idea of Oren and Omri, basically what you can expect as a good job has to be assessed according to the whole performance. Again, because comparability is, you have already a good manager, even if from time to time he doesn't take the good decision. The business judgment rule is another emanation of this idea. Now, I'm afraid that I already spoke 15 minutes, therefore I will tell you about foreseeability only. We don't have the foreseeability exception in German law, but only in German law. Italian law has it, French law has it, even in Europe it's the majority rule, and of course in the common law system it is. It is one of those pockets of fault law, because foreseeability, of course, we have it in other aspects as well, not with respect to damages, we have it in German law as well. Nevertheless, I, contrary to what you might think, because I was so much in favor of strict liability, etc., etc., I think that there is a good reason for not accepting the foreseeability exception in German law, and that has to do again with the idea that damages often are somehow difficult to prove, and that perhaps you need some overcompensation. German law goes for this type of not going too much into the problems of damages by a strict rule specific performance. One tries to avoid all the problems damages have, and therefore, I think the general idea about excluding the foreseeability exception, about going for a specific performance, is basically that damages is always a problem with respect to proof, and that therefore you should avoid that as much as possible. But that, I think, is another discourse, as many other variants which somehow soften the strict liability. In my paper, there is one other, which is the so-called second chance, which is important for Europe, But I think I'd rather go for the discussion with you than for teaching you still a bit more about European law. Thank you for your attention. Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of push a little bit on the service side of the analysis that you gave. So I think your intuitions are basically right, but a little bit incomplete. That is, there's no question, for example, if you take a service contract on medical malpractice, judging by whether a patient lives or dies and trying to figure out whether that makes sense is going to be an impossibility. But the question is, once you switch to the input side rather than to the output side, how do you do it? And that was not something that you discussed much in this conversation. And there are two approaches. One of them, which I've always thought to be a horrific mistake, was to try to use a generalized cost-benefit formula on the retail level. And certainly in American law, that has always been rejected in medical cases in favor of a relatively strong customer best practices standard. And I think the point of that standard is, and I'm just curious if you agree, is that if in fact you are going to go to the input side, you still have the comparability and the trade stuff that you want to do across customers, right? And if you just have a reasonable care standard, it won't work. So what we do is we have sort of sub-rules. We have board-certified physicians, and they have the one protocol. We have generalists, and we do to another, and so on down the line. And then with respect to these procedures, we develop practice guidelines. And what that does is it doesn't get rid of the problem of trying to figure out whether there was a deviation from the norm, but it means that at least you know what the norm is from which there's a deviation. So you don't have both things, service level and standard level, being done. And I think it's consistent with the kind of approach that you have, isn't it? Because it has all the same kinds of imperatives. And this then also ties into the tort contract overlap, because if you go back to the Roman law stuff on the concurrence of actions, whenever they had the jeweler who had to break a stone, right? Whether you call it a contract of hire or whether you called it something under the lex aequilia, essentially it was a bona fide standard under industry practices. So this has a very long genre going back to it. That's sort of where you are, isn't it?
Well, you are always grateful to discussants who asked you the questions you couldn't explain in the paper or in your speech, and these are two very important ones. You are completely right in assuming that probably I would rather go for this. How do you call it? Customer best standard.
Best practice standard.
Basically, the idea is that you don't have on the one side this longing for comparability. On the other side, you don't have it. Of course, you have it as well for services. You just can't do it as well from the result. But on the input side, of course, you try to have comparability as much as possible. In my paper, I write about a very important area, which is investment services, where one of the big things is how you execute an order, a client's order, and you have different possibilities of manipulation. And then the new Investment Services Directive in Europe chose a way to say, well, each investment service provider just defines his approach of how he handles orders, and he published that. And then after a certain while, he has to stick to that, of course. And then after a certain while, he assesses that, how would other strategies, which would have been the outcome of other strategies, and he has to publish that. And then you have a very simple figure somehow at a certain time, and of course everybody, and that the investment provider has a big incentive in doing his best job, because otherwise, afterwards it will be published again. Comparability, of course, is the main aim. And the same is true, of course, in the medical treatment that you have. You try to break down the different standards as much as possible. For instance, that you say, well, we try to define reasonable care by what are the standards in this profession or in this profession, in this sub-profession, in this way somehow. You try to have as much comparability on the input side as possible as well. Now, with respect to the tort and contract law question, I forgot to say why do I think that comparability works better in contracts, or this idea works better, and the freedom of contract idea better in contracts than in torts. It works in part in torts as well, as long as I wouldn't say the divide is really contracts and torts, but rather activities which you can plan and where comparability plays a role, and others where it doesn't play a role. And of course, product liability is rather close to contracts in this respect, and therefore it's strict liability. But for the normal tort, I would say the basic idea is you can promise or you can give up your freedom afterwards by a promise in a rather restricted area. If you say, I promise this or that, then you can pay attention and you can say, I take the guarantee for that, typically. Whereas you can't do it for your whole life. There, I think this freedom idea has some good idea behind it. And therefore, on the contract law side, therefore I said, if basically what you are promising is a service which encompasses all your workforce and for a long time, then you can't promise, the result will always be optimal. Then you promise normal good management skills and not more. And therefore, I think in torts, for the sake of freedom, so to speak, a fault principle is more sensible in general tort law, not those specific torts where you would say, well, product liability, you have those procedures, and perhaps also in specific sectors like traffic circulation, where you can say, yes, there you have to pay this utmost attention or so, but in others not. Traffic circulation, of course, there's another aspect, which is insurance. Why you should have strict liability.
Yes. Can I press you on this idea of foreseeability and how it differs across jurisdictions? As I look at your paper, I'm not sure it's really that much different in Germany. You take the standard Hadley versus Baxendale hypothetical where I'm going to climb Mount Everest, I go to the local drugstore and buy a package of film, turns out the film is defective, I climb to the top of Mount Everest, pictures don't come out, I sue the drugstore for selling me the defective film. My guess is that in Germany, I'm not going to be able to get the costs of climbing Mount Everest to get it from the drugstore.
Yeah, yeah. The rule is similar, can be similar in outcome, but somehow the burden of argumentation and of proof is somehow different. We do it with the duty to mitigate damages, which we see as a duty which starts right in the beginning in the pre-contractual phase already. You have to do everything that the contract can be carried through as performed as properly as possible, only that the promisor has to show that you haven't done it and that we ask for the causal link of failure to do so, what did it as harm to the promisor. And there you would say, well, if it's completely out of what, if it's very high damages for a low budget product, then you have to tell the promisor. But nevertheless, I think it's not seen as a general rule that damages are limited to foreseeable damages right away, but if it's somehow way beyond a balanced outcome, then you would say, well, then you had a duty to inform the promisor before, and then if you haven't done it, you are responsible for the harm done to the promisor by not having done it.
You know, even then, it's different from Hadley versus Baxendale, which again is a disclosure rule, and again, we have these rules about overdraft.
As I said, the outcome very often will not be very different. It's rather the concept. It's not one of general limitation, but rather one of exception. But you are right that the differences aren't that big.
So that's the 254, right?
The
254 of the BGB.
Yeah.
And you also have the directness, I think, right? In instead of possibility, it should be direct.
No, no, no. Under German law, you don't have a limitation to direct damages.
Okay, but my question is this. Could you say more about the fault in this? I mean, what is fault here, right? I mean, when there is no fault, there is no liability. If you told the burden of proof is on the omissor, still you can prove that there is no fault. Could you say more about this notion of fault? Could you give us, maybe one or two examples? But probably it's not just, the fact that performance is inefficient probably would not be enough, right? I mean, if the omissor do not perform and say, well, performance was inefficient, would it be liable or not?
Not in conformity with the contract, you would say. What inefficient or what?
Well, I mean, that's exactly my question. What is the fault, right? What is the no fault defense?
Well,
it's certainly not just an argument which says performance is inefficient, right? That would not be enough, I guess. It's something else.
The general rule is somehow different. Now, I'm speaking about Germany and Italy again on the one hand and France on the other. The general rule in Germany and Italy would be we have what we call an objective standard of care. So you say not what was possible to this person or that person, but what would have been possible to a good a professional in this situation, to a good private person in this, according to what type of person you have. And in addition, you have a reversal of burden of proof only in contract law, not in tort law. That means that the promisor has to show that he observed good professional standards according to this standard. Now, this, however, is only half the truth. And that is because of the rule I was already telling you, that is that the seller doesn't respond for fault by the producer. And that means that in typically you have a production chain. And typically the seller didn't cause the defect of the product, and therefore in the main field of application of strict liability, the sales law, in fact, you have a very strong fault principle in Germany, which is so strong that you don't have damages typically.
Yeah, but when you say performance was possible for them, but suppose it was possible but very expensive. What then?
Yeah.
Say there is no fault here?
The rule somehow which would define the area of efficient breach is one where one would say, well, efficient breach or exceptions, okay, you can negotiate as promisor with the promisee, but you'd have an ex lege exceptions only in very exceptional cases. It has to be the law has changed a little bit in the current reform of 2002, and there you have this, which is economically grossly unreasonable. You needn't do it any longer. Then you are exempt from liability. Grossly unreasonable and relatively limited cases. So, and the efficient breach under German law would just run like that. You have specific performance, so you can force the promisor, but in normal cases it's damages nevertheless, and then you can of course negotiate, but the promisor as such doesn't have the right to efficient breach.
I want to ask you about your thesis, the comparability idea. I think it's a very kind of nice idea. I'm just wondering, does it really help us explain, so the point is strict liability makes it consistent with Eric Posner's idea that you need to know less about the product, when you compare, because you know you don't know much about how likely, what are the propensities of different competitors in terms of the likelihood to be negligent. You don't need to know that. All you need to know is what the product, what's the value of the product to you, and then you easier to compare. But it's when you dig a little deeper, I'm not sure I'm persuaded that this explains the shift to strict liability. If you talk about small value products, it doesn't really matter to buyers that they have strict liability, because for a small value widget or product, you're not going to sue. So what you really want to know is what is the propensity of the seller to perform that contract, and so that is not something that strict liability rule gives you. You need to go to some other maybe extra legal mechanisms to figure out what that is. If they already exist, they can also tell you stuff about this likelihood of negligence. If you talk about big ticket item, sale of a car, you could have a negligence regime. It doesn't matter, because for one, first the buyer will do a lot of check out things in consumer reports and stuff like this, and look at ratings and stuff like this. And furthermore, the seller is likely to give some kind of warranty, maybe opt into some kind of expansive strict liability regime anyway. So whether it's low ticket or big ticket item, it doesn't seem like the comparability issue gives you much traction here in terms of choosing strict liability or negligence. Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's what we are speaking about is really how the default rule should be. That you can have a guarantee is evident, then the default rule is fault liability, and then you have the guarantee, or the other way around. If you have strict liability, of course, you can have an exclusion of liability as well. So it's the default rule. And of course, with small widgets, in some cases, of course, with those small claims, you have it on the procedural level. You can these things you can't capture with strict liability versus negligence. Negligence is perhaps even worse, but strict liability doesn't really help. If it's $10 or so, $100, nobody will sue. You can do it procedurally, either with a small claims court or with class actions, if the cases are appropriate for that. But it's not a question of fault or not a non-fault, I think. With the bigger cases, you are right. You can do it with a guarantee. Perhaps I'm more for the default rule, mainly also because of defects I'm seeing in several European countries, and that is mainly the defect with the production chain. That there it really matters, and that you have to have a guarantee with the producer, and to know that, you as a customer, to know that actually, despite consumer associations and so, to know as a customer that the guarantee plays a major role if you are really, that you don't have a remedy of damages against your seller if the car has a defect, is the main reason why I would say the default rule should be the other way around. Yeah.
Clarify something you said a few minutes ago. You said that the promissory in the efficient breach case would be entitled to specific performance. But then you said that normally he'd just get damages. And I wondered whether you meant, he'd prefer damages, or they would negotiate damages, or whether the judge could, as a matter of discretion, say, you'll have to settle for damages.
All three apply. We have the rule of specific performance, but it has exceptions. There is, in fact, a discretion of the judge. Judges normally give specific performance only if they are convinced that damages don't do it, really. So even there, In principle, it's a big difference, specific performance on the one hand, and damages with the exceptional cases for a specific performance. In reality, in front of the in court, I think the difference is not so big. But there are very few cases because most parties, if it's not so important, go for the damages then. Yes.
We've got time for one more question.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you about the European Investment Services Law, which is interesting for a lot of reasons, partly because it does involve disclosure. And even though we've talked about fault in other areas, we haven't talked about the disclosure or misrepresentation aspect. The question I have, if the different investment services have to disclose their procedures and so on, what effect does that actually have on their customers? I mean, do customers read it and shop around among fund investment firms to find ones that they think have practices they really like? And does that encourage the investment firms to compete? Or are there third-party intermediaries that read these disclosures and put out investor advisories that say you really have to go with this company because they have better procedures? Or is it just kind of ignored?
Well, typically you have two types of intermediaries, at least in Germany and more generally in Europe. And those are, of course, the financial intermediaries, but as well those consumer associations or investors associations, though it's published quite a bit. empirical data are not possible because this directive dates of 2006 and has just been transposed. I think that this will be the outcome somehow, that it will be intermediaries telling that and not customers. But that is the normal thing somehow in the financial services area. I must have something to say also in 10 years when I come.
Thank you very much.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.